The reality is that these are agents that are doing things for you based on very minimum supervision.
In security, all too often, we're seen as either the roadblocks or the speed bumps.
Nick, you're a total buzzkill. We're experts at finding the dark cloud in every silver lining.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where our expert panelists turn the biggest industry news stories into practical takeaways you can use. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and not a single one of my Moltbook posts has gone viral. Zero. The bots do not like me, folks. Joining me today, Sridhar Mupidi, IBM Fellow, CTO, IBM Security, Nick Bradley of X-Force Incident Command and the Not the Situation Room podcast, and Jeff Kroom, distinguished engineer, master inventor, AI and data security, and he's playing through the pain today, folks. And here's what we're going to be talking about. Is the move fast and break things moment over? The Notepad++ breach, DragonForce's ransomware cartel. But first, OpenClaw, Claude Opus 4.6, and Shadow AI. What is going on with enterprise agent security? AI agent security in the enterprise seems to be at kind of an inflection point right now. Last week was a very busy week. We covered OpenClaw, the open source AI agent with some major security concerns, and its own social media network, although it is worth noting that according to an MIT investigation, a lot of the Moltbook behavior was just people pretending to be AI agents, so take it with a grain of salt. But last week also saw the release of Claude Opus 4.6, notable particularly for the introduction of agent teams. These are swarms of multiple Claude agents that can divide and conquer big engineering or analysis tasks. So looking at this news, I kind of see two visions of agentic implementation here, right? You've got OpenClaw's kind of anarchic but highly customizable open source approach, and Anthropic's proprietary models that are a little more locked down, but there's some security in that. And I can see the benefits to both sides, so I kind of want to throw it to the panelists here, because you're the security experts. When you look at these things, open source versus proprietary agents, what kind of security concerns do you have? Do you lean one way or the other? Jeff, I want to start with you. What's your take here?
Sure. Well, I guess if we're talking about having an AI agent, which is essentially a model accessing tools in a loop, operating autonomously, and you're going to use open source materials. So in other words, let somebody else write code, and we don't know who somebody else is, and we don't know what they've done or how trustworthy they are, how skilled they are. And we're going to turn that loose on our system and give it maybe system-level privileges so that it can modify files, enter terminal commands, and stuff like that. I don't see how any of this could possibly go wrong. It looks like it's going to be just perfect from a security standpoint. There was no mistake in any of those kind of logical points that we connect. Obviously, I'm being facetious. This is something that is tremendously powerful if it's used well. But the fact of the matter is most people, this is going to be very opaque. They're not going to see what's going into all of these systems. They're not going to know what it does. They're using a repository and then they're giving it. I mean, it's the same thing as if you're just downloading code from any old source and maybe it's got backdoors and malware and all kinds of other source in it. Now, though, it's an AI agent which can do all of this stuff autonomously and at scale. So the issues are more significant. And I think a well-heeled security principle has never been more important than it is in the world of agentic AI, and that's the principle of least privilege. We have to lock these things down, only give them access that is absolutely necessary, that we approve of, that we understand, and don't give it to it for any longer than is necessary. So just very, very minimal. Lock these things down. Don't let them run under your super user account or you'll regret it.
Concerns that came up last week when we talked about OpenClaw was that a lot of users might not totally get what they might not understand what they're getting into with this, right? Like an AI agent is a very different kind of piece of software than your standard app. And so when you install that kind of thing, you're opening up doors you might not know that you're opening up. Sridhar, how about you? What's your take here on the kind of open source agent versus proprietary agent question? Do you lean one way or the other in a security context? What are you thinking about?
Well, I think that's not a new topic for us, right? We've been dealing with open source for a number of years. I think the bigger problem over here is these are the agents. And even if it's a proprietary model or proprietary software, it's a very, nascent area. We are all maturing over here in this space, right? So regardless of whether it's open source, for sure, open source adds another layer of, security risk, like whether it is supply chain related issues. But the reality is that these are agents that are doing things for you based on very minimum supervision, right? And that's scary to me. That is scary in terms of how much you want to give them permission to do. So whether it's open source, whether it is in a closed source or the proprietary model, I think what makes sense is, to be able to go provide a sanctioned option, right? People tend to use unsanctioned only because there's no other option. So embrace that, give people a sanctioned option. Like Jeff said, treat every agent like an insider, right? Or a privileged account, whether it's open source or not open source. Make sure they're only allowed to do what they are allowed to do and nothing more or nothing less. And then, provide things like OpenClaws or Claude with some more guardrails, right? Some rules on which they can act. For example, it's okay to say, hey, go install the software, but maybe leverage a playbook, a defined playbook that has been tested out versus open-ended tasks that may cause more problems.
That makes a lot of sense. The open source and the proprietary models might have slightly different backgrounds, but at the end of the day, that question of access and least privilege and guardrails is kind of the same for both of them. Nick, how about you? What's your take here on this open source versus proprietary agent debate? Any thoughts there?
Open source has caused a different problem here in that we're moving so fast and there's so many options that they don't even have to use software vulnerabilities to take advantage of things that have been that were oversights, right? Because we're so fast to want to take advantage of the monetary value here because we can save time, we can save resources. It's something we can implement. We don't have to hire more employees, and we'll worry about security later because we can get the job done now. And then by the time you realize that it's too late and you run into situations like what happened with OpenClaw, where it was running the indirect prompt injections and it thought it wasn't doing anything wrong. It was processing exactly what it was supposed to and you get busted. So I know we're not going to change and move away from open source and stay proprietary completely because if you do that, you take away the advantage of having the hive mind to contribute to development as well, right? So it's a very multifaceted risk, and you have to decide what parts you want to take advantage of and which parts you're not, and do it smartly. And the problem is that's not always the case.
Yeah, and I think what Nick is talking about, people are going to do this. Whether we want them to or not, and Sridhar made a reference to this as well, we can, and I'm a big proponent of this idea, don't say no, say how. So if we just tell people don't do it, and we don't give them, as Sridhar said, a sanctioned option, an approved version, then they're just going to go do it in the bad way. So it's a whole lot better to say, don't say no, we're not doing agents, they're too risky. Say, we're not doing agents in the wide open universe, just find any agent you want and turn it loose on our system. Here are a set of agents that we have tested out that we think are useful and we think are not going to, blow us up in the process. So use these. Say how. Don't just tell people don't do it.
Yeah, and all three of you, this is very interesting to me, right? Because all three of you are gesturing towards something that I wanted to bring up in this conversation, which is this question of shadow AI, right? And the pressures that make people adopt this kind of thing when there is no sanctioned option. And the thing is that presenting people with a sanctioned option requires some time, right? It requires some part of the organization to test these things out, decide how to deploy them. But we've got a survey from Black Fog recently that showed that about half of respondents are using unapproved AI at work. And moreover, 69% of presidents and executive leaders surveyed for this survey said that they prioritize speed over privacy and security when it comes to AI adoption. So I'm kind of wondering if the we're sitting here talking about how important it is to have sanctioned options, but like, do we have a leadership, C-suite sending a different message that's kind of, making people adopt some things that maybe they shouldn't move into? Is this a, I don't know, maybe we're not all on the same page. Sridhar, any thoughts there on that tension?
I think the leaders want innovation. The leaders want speed, right? I mean, we have come to embrace that. And speed is important to help grow the business. But at the same time, part of that is we have to figure out how to do it. We were talking about running before this, like disciplined running or disciplined way of going to speed versus getting off the gate and running at 60 miles an hour, right? So I'm not going to blame the execs per se. I mean, this is what they need for running the business, and you need to go faster, cheaper, better. It's for the technologies to go and vet out, you know, what are the models which are approved? What are the agents which are approved? And even for the agents which are approved, how do you put some guardrails, right? I'm not talking about doing a 600-page report about surveying everything. Pick one. They all pretty much at the same level of maturity. Pick one or two or three, and then put some level of guardrails, some level of process on that. Go through the process of education and the risk of potentially data being exposed unintentionally, right? And that might help curb some of the behavior around shadow IT or the shadow agent or shadow AI these days, right?
Sadly, I fully agree with you, but sadly, I don't know if I think there is a solution. And I hate saying that because it feels like just giving up, but it's not what I mean. I mean, I feel like it's the same as the same growing pains we have felt with technology and security all along, which is where I said before, you know, let's use it now or get it implemented now and figure out the security later. And sometimes the later doesn't happen or it happens too late. And it's still what's going to happen. It's almost like we know how it works. History is still going to repeat itself because in security, all too often, we're seen as either the roadblocks or the speed bumps that are, you know, we're the party poopers. You're not letting us use the cool stuff, like trying to protect you. But sometimes it's just ignored until that catastrophe happens. And then it turns around and they want to know why we didn't warn them.
Nick, you're a total buzzkill.
Yeah, I'd be in the buzzkill today. Man.
That's right.
I think one thing, Nick, right? It's never all or nothing, right? You'll never be able to finish a research on all the tools out there, right? And there's always going to be the next vulnerability coming tomorrow morning. We know that. The question is, how do you take a risk-based approach, right? How do you take a risk-based approach enough to basically move the needle fast enough with the appropriate risk? Now, granted, you know, you cannot control all the risks. So how do you then have some level of fail-safe or some level of mitigation after the fact, right? So I'm suggesting a process or a disciplined way of going about this, because the undisciplined way is chaos.
Oh, for sure. The issue, though, that I'm kind of trying to highlight here is that this isn't just an issue with AI and LLMs now. It's an issue we've been dealing with forever, right? How often in a corporate, you know, do we try to say, here is the approved list of products you're allowed to use to do your job? Somebody's still going to find a way to use some third-party product that they think works better because they know how to use it, and they're going to figure out how to do it. Even if it's end of life or it's cracked software they downloaded from a pirated site or something along those lines, and then everything you tried to do is out the window.
Yeah, when the security organization said Wi-Fi is too dangerous, we're not going to put that in the office, then what did people do? They went out to the local computer store, bought a Wi-Fi router, and plugged it into the Ethernet port in their office. And then now they have Wi-Fi.
Bob's your uncle, we got Wi-Fi.
Exactly. Bring your own IT, bring your own device. Now it's bring your own cloud. Now it's bring your own AI. And that will never change, which is, again, why we have to say how. Give them a better option, or at least a good enough option, so that they're not tempted to go off the rails.
It does seem to me that with AI, it's almost like even harder to not be the party pooper, because something new and cool like OpenClaw comes out like every week. You know what I mean? And so I like this idea that you know, Sridhar, you had mentioned where it's, you know, you can kind of balance security and speed by just, you know, picking a couple of them because they all kind of work the same, saying these are the approved ones, put them in place. But it's almost like you can do that. And like Nick said, someone's going to be like, yeah, but I think this OpenClaw thing is really cool, so I'm just going to download that instead. And it's like, I guess the, you know, ultimately what we're running up against here, which we run up against all the time, is that, like, there's, you know, the organization can do everything it can, but at the end of the day, there's that user, and you cannot control your users. You cannot control their every move. So you secure what you can, I guess, is the takeaway here, yes. Right?
Like, Nick just doesn't want us to have any fun. I mean, that's the bottom line.
No, I do not.
Exactly.
Well, I think, you know, this is a natural moment to kind of seg into our next, conversation topic here. Have we moved too fast and broken too many things? Now, I'm asking that question because I read an op-ed on CyberScoop recently by Sasa Jelar, who is chief trust officer at Reversing Labs. And in this op-ed, he argues that the era of moving fast and breaking things, I'm sure we've all heard this slogan before, has led to a security crisis. Now, in Jelar's telling, by prioritizing speed over almost everything else, we've made it normal to release vulnerable code that makes cybercriminals' jobs much easier. I'm thinking about what Nick said before about, you know, implement it and worry about security later. Then the question is, do we ever actually worry about the security? So I'm wondering what we think about this idea that, you know, the move fast and break things philosophy has led us to a kind of security crisis, and if it's time to move on. And Sridhar, I'll throw to you first. What's your take here?
We don't need to slow down per se. For sure, we need to go and need to move in a more disciplined manner, right? But that doesn't mean we stop everything. When we stop everything, we can't put food on the table, right? Each of the companies that they have to survive, each of the company have to differentiate against their competitors and innovate and go faster, cheaper, better. But we have to go through the discipline of, you know, stepping back and doing the right things, right? If not, bad things will happen. As you said, we've got, looking at an organization, 550,000 unpatched vulnerabilities, right? I mean, why did we allow that much of vulnerabilities? I like the culture of, you know, don't ship anything which has vulnerabilities. So I think there's a part of it is the rigor that we have to put in to make sure that whether it is a supply chain process, whether it's a third party, whatever you're doing, how do I have a level of rigor in terms of what you're taking or what you're not taking? How do I have a level of transparency? We talk about software bill of materials. There's crypto bill of materials. There's, you know, let's make up a word today, Jeff, agent bill of materials, right? AI bill of materials, ML bill of materials, right? Let's make those up.
Trademark.
Right. Trademark it, right?
You heard it here first.
T-shirts.
Right. So that you're providing the level of transparency and what is going on, and then be able to go and put the appropriate policies or rules or models to be able to mitigate against those, right? So that's my high-level approach over here, which is, yes, you know, don't slow down, go in a controlled manner, and do it with some level of rigor, both in people, process, and technology.
Yeah, and that reminds me of something that Dustin Haywood said when we had him on the show a few weeks back, which was that ultimately no organization is in the business of being secure, right? Their business aims is not being secure, and security has to support those business aims, all right? And that's kind of what you're talking about, right, Sridhar? You can't, like you said, you can't slow down, or else you can't put food on the table, but you do have to figure out a way of balancing these things. Jeff, I want to throw to you next. What's your take here on this idea that move fast and break things, the moment's over, it's led to a crisis, we got to try something else. What's your take here?
I'm going to say I feel like I'm particularly well qualified to weigh in on this topic of move fast and break things, because that's what I did about a week ago when I was moving fast on my daily run. I hit an ice patch and broke my shoulder. So I have a firsthand experience with how this works. And doesn't end well, I'm just going to tell you. So there are lessons to be learned. Also,
well played,
I thought about
by
this
the way.
Also.
Well played.
Oh, thank you.
That was
I figured he picked, you picked that story just to pick on me, but yeah, okay. It's all right, I can take it. Big shoulders, even though one of them's broken, I can still bear it on the other. This also sounds like something that if my three-year-old grandson could articulate, he would think this is a good idea as well. Just go fast and break things because, you know, mom or dad or granddad will get a new one, you know, and, you know, from his perspective, that makes sense because you're in exploration mode. And maybe if you're a gajillionaire, then this works for you economically as well. You can afford enough lawyers that whatever you break, you can just throw them after the problem and, you know, keep moving along because you're already breaking more things down the road, but you're making enough profit in the process. This is kind of going back to the
the business perspective of this, like Sridhar was referring to, as opposed to the natural security way that we look at things, where we're trying to not break things. We're trying to keep things intact. So there's always going to be that kind of uneasy tension. I think generally just saying break, you know, move fast and break things, I think is irresponsible. I think there's a spirit of entrepreneurship and we should move faster. We should execute with speed. We should execute with scale. But, you know, and I've used this example before. I didn't come up with this, but I love this analogy. The question of why you put brakes on a car. And the answer is not to stop. It's so you can go really fast. And the reason I know that's the case, because how fast would you drive a car that had no brakes? You wouldn't. So security is the brakes on the car that let you take calculated risk. The you know, move fast and break things says, I'm throwing risk to the wind. I'm throwing caution to the wind. I'm not really looking at that. So I don't think that's a scalable model. I think eventually it comes back to haunt you, as my left shoulder is telling me. And eventually there's a price to be paid. So, but I also think the era of AI that we're in is encouraging even more. So the not only is the velocity increasing, the acceleration is increasing. So the rate of change is happening faster. So this is going to be more and more of what we find, whether people verbalize it that way or not. I think this is the world we live in, but it's not one that we should accept blindly. It's one where we do need to put brakes on the car. Then I can run this lane like a Formula One race car instead of a Flintstone mobile, where I can't afford to go very fast in this thing because it's going to crash.
I like the idea of security being a thing that actually lets you go faster, right? Like it's not the thing that slows you down. It's actually the thing that lets you go even faster. So it's like we can modify that phrase to, you know, move fast and protect things. I don't know. Something, you guys can come up with something catchier. You're way better at that stuff. But Nick, let me bring you in here. And I also want to, you know, you have the bad luck, basically, of coming after Jeff because he brought up something that's really important, which is how vibe coding and this kind of new era of AI development might make this worse. So like when you look at this situation, you know, I think about not just how moving fast and breaking things, whether the time is up, but like, are we going to start moving even faster and breaking even more things and making security's job even worse? So what's your take here?
I think saying, you know, going worst case scenario, I am going to say that we'll move fast and break things really is kind of a misleading statement because it almost implies that we're breaking things on a purpose. And I just think that's misleading because that is not the goal. It's just a side effect. And it's a side effect of trying to get there as fast as you can. And yeah, we're going to take calculated risks, sometimes calculated less than we should or more than we should. But the whole point at the end of the day is we're going to do it. It's going to happen. And it's not new with AI. And I think I've said this on one of the other episodes before. I'll say it again. The issue is if you halt, you catch fire.
No, that makes a lot of sense, right? And so I like that you point out, right, that the breaking things is not the point, right? Like, it's not like we're saying, hey, you got to break things. It's just kind of a side effect, right? And so, again, keeps coming back to this theme we're developing here, and I like when we do this, where it's like you got to balance that security and that business perspective. But the question is how? And Jalar's proposed alternative approach to move fast and break things is, quote, make smart and safe things. But I'm kind of wondering, okay, you got a slogan now. That's great. Well, what does that actually look like? Sridhar, I see you starting to talk here. What's your take?
No, I think it starts with the slogan. It starts with the motto, right? It starts with the mission to say, yes, we're going to go, you know, Jeff's analogy, right? The velocity is fine, but wreckage is not fine, right? Or your point about move faster, but build safely. I think the mission is important to start with. But then from a technology perspective, you got to figure out how to bake security into the pipeline, right? DevOps or DevSecOps or CI/CD pipelines, MLOps or MLSecOps, whatever that is. There's so many tools right there in terms of, you know, scanning the code or not, you know, with static scanning, dynamic scanning, red teaming. So we got to have the philosophy of how do I do things as a part of the pipeline so that it doesn't slow you down as much, but allows you to go and have the kill switches, allows you to go and do the basic things. The hygiene is what I call, right? Then comes the question of the transparency that I was talking about, right? Because it's not just four of us sitting in a room and writing code that we can peer over each other's shoulders. It's open source, open tooling, SaaS vendors, there's a number of different things that make up a software, that make up a solution. So how do you provide that transparency from the different vendors, right? We started coining names before with like very similar to software bill of materials, to crypto bill of materials. But we need to demand that transparency from the SaaS vendors, from the AI vendors, to say, you know, what are they doing, or how they're mitigating it, so that we can then figure out how do you go and provide some risk on when to use it and when not to use it. So not everybody has a Formula One car, but you know, you can have a Toyota Corolla, you know, at going at a speed that some may want it, and some may want it at the Formula One speed, and putting a brakes that are for Formula One, designed for Formula One on Toyota, doesn't make sense, right? So I think having the right business model, use cases, and balancing out the mitigation, that might help go faster.
And one thing, just a moment of hope for us, because you know it's very easy for security guys to, we're experts at finding the dark cloud in every silver lining. But you know, with AI out there and vibe coding and the ability to generate all kinds of just really awful code, guess what? AI could also do code reviews for us as well, and maybe suss out what some of that really awful code is and tell us what some of the vulnerabilities could be. So this is one of the things that it's not only taking away, it also could add to the process as well and become the guards and the oversight that we need. So AI is neither good nor bad. It depends on how we use it. And it could be used for good in this case.
That's a great statement. I just feel like all technology over the years, as we continue to develop, you could say the same thing about all of it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier with this kind of release of Claude Opus 4.6, that's Anthropic used that to do like they used Opus to do like a code review of a bunch of open source libraries, and they found something like 500 undiscovered vulnerabilities, right? So it's like, that's an example of using that AI to help us kind of do that thing, right? AI doesn't just have to accelerate slop, it can accelerate some of the good stuff we do, right? And I also, like, before we move on, I just want to emphasize, you know, Sridhar, I like how you pointed out that, like, even if we're talking about a paradigm shift and we have a new kind of slogan here, the tools to do this kind of thing, we're already intimately familiar with them, right? Like DevSecOps is a thing. Bills of materials are a thing. We have the models. We can just apply them in a more maybe, I don't know, targeted or strategic way. But it's not like we're starting from scratch here. All right, let's move on to our next story for the day, folks. The Notepad++ breach. Last week, Rapid7 reported on Chrysalis, a previously undocumented backdoor delivered through Notepad++'s updater client. Threat actors were able to gain access to Notepad++'s server for about 6 months, during which time they distributed the backdoor to a number of targets. It wasn't a mass campaign. It seems like it was a very targeted effort. Now, Notepad++ has since switched servers and addressed the authentication weakness that allowed the hijack to happen, so it's not an active issue anymore. And I'm not so much interested in the story of a single compromise here and what happened in Notepad++, but whether it represents a broader trend. Because I saw Mark Thomason, one of the founders of the Cyber Threat Intelligence Capability Maturity Model, on LinkedIn talking about this. And his take was that this breach highlights, and this is a quote from him, the absolute lack of oversight for utilities like this, the overall poor scrutiny of supplier risk programs, and generally weak software inventory practices. This idea of bills of materials popping up again already. But Nick, I want to throw to you first, because I know you folks talked about this on the most recent Not the Situation Room. What do you think about the Notepad++ breach? Is this a sign of something bigger? Is this just, it's a breach and it happens. What's your take here?
It's not exactly novel, but what makes this one feel like it's novel is it had such a big footprint, right? Because we've seen supply chain compromises before. We saw a lot of it throughout last year, but this one affected so many people on such a level that it even got the attention of people that don't know anything about security. Now, whether this was actually open sourced or not, it's the same problem. If you compromise the supply chain, the reason it's such a big deal to me is because one of our mantras that we just love to preach is patch your stuff, right? Well, in this case, patching your stuff is exactly what got you kicked in the gut. So sometimes there's no silver bullet. This one is the oversight, as was mentioned by the quote you stated before. So I don't have a whole lot more to add on this one because it's pretty straightforward, but it is downright sneaky.
The thing that worries me over here is it's such a utility tool. It's like curl. When did I ever think about doing an inventory on curl? When did I ever do an inventory on VI in my system, right? Or Notepad, or these are such tools that we use, like, which are so matter-of-facty and given, right? It worries me when somebody is targeting these, like, because even if you do a software inventory, we don't do this, right? So my wake-up moment for this is, I think software inventory is really software inventory. It's not the big software per se, but every little thing on your laptop, right, every little thing that you use is probably a more revelation for me with this attack, right? And of course, there are other ways to mitigate it, but that's pretty much the starting point for me.
Right. Well, I mean, in this case, the issue is, and I think you were saying this, is that the level of implied trust in a tool like this is so absolute that the idea of it being compromised just was unfathomable. And that's all my big words for the rest of this podcast.
Oh, that's it. Okay. All right. Trust was the big word?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. No, that actually hit on the point that I wanted to make as well. We went through a while where we were talking about zero trust, and then a lot of people soured on it because, quite honestly, vendors absconded the term and abused it beyond belief as a way to just sell everything they had on the truck. So, as people will, they got tired of hearing about it. But I'm a cybersecurity architect. Zero trust principles are good, and they're still good, regardless what vendors call them or not. And it means not trusting anything you haven't verified. And it comes down to things like this. Third-party risk is a risk that is continuing to grow because nobody writes all their code anymore, right? If that was ever the case. But we're depending on more and more components from more and more places, which we don't know about, which means if we're depending on them, we're trusting them. And implicit trust is the opposite of zero trust, which says, I'm going to verify and then trust. So trust follows verification. I think we're needing more in the way of tools and oversight because individuals can't look at all this. Our systems are far too complex for any person to go and look at all of it and say, yep, it's all good to go. Oh, by the way, the software just changed because it changes all the time. Now you have to go back and reevaluate the entire system again? No, not possible. So here again, if we do this right, AI could help us. It could be one of the technologies that comes in and helps and scan all of these things and looks for abnormal behaviors and flags those things for us. It's not perfect, but you know, we talked about at the beginning of this episode how the speed at which these things operate is dangerous for us, but here's where the speed could actually come back to benefit us because it can look for these kind of failures across a mass scale and let us know about it if we do it right.
Yeah, I like that you point out, there's three things actually that I want to emphasize there, Jeff. The first is that souring on zero trust. Because like I feel like I've watched that happen. I feel like when I sort of started in security, you know, covering this world a few years back, it was everywhere. Everybody's talking about zero trust all the time. You don't see that really anymore. And I do think it's partially because, like you said, vendors started to kind of abuse the term. So that's the first thing I want to emphasize is that, like, you know, we've kind of soured this, but it is still really important. And the second thing is that even when you are implementing zero trust, like you said, sometimes it doesn't get to that granular level of like the Notepad program on that laptop, right? Like you've got to get real smart. And like Sridhar said, an inventory's got to be a real inventory, an actual inventory, right? It's got to be every little thing. But how do you do that, right? And that's the kind of third thing I wanted to ask is like, how do you do that? And you gestured toward AI there, Jeff, and that makes a lot of sense to me. But I'm wondering if we have any other kind of lessons or takeaways that we think organizations should kind of learn from this situation, you know, in addition to using that AI, that true approach to zero trust, and that really granular take on inventories. And Nick, I guess I'll throw to you first. Are there any lessons you feel like organizations should be taken away from this aside from what we've enumerated here already?
I have to think back to some of my previous jobs or previous missions before I was actually in security and didn't realize that it was going to be part of it. And I won't name the company, but I will say this company used to not allow anything to be installed in their environment unless they had processed the MSI, right? The Microsoft installer package. So you had to go to their store and anything you wanted to install had to be something that they had put together for you. And I was part of the team that wrote those MSIs. So in this case, if we had had a vulnerable or a compromised version of Notepad++, we would have seen it in the process of developing the installer that you as an employee would have been allowed to use. So that is one option. I have to say, I think that's probably an expensive option. But if AI can do that for us, then I think that might not be a bad path to consider.
It goes back to probably the found framework that, Jeff, you defined, right? Zero trust, which is one is, I think we talked about elevating the inventory to even the boring software, right? Not just a cool software, but the boring software and all that. But Jeff, you talked about trust, verify, et cetera, right? But I think part of it is monitoring. Part of it is monitoring as well, right? Continuous monitoring to be able to say, are we getting updates from repositories that we don't know of, right? Or could we have updates come from some sanctioned repository that you may want to mirror from a public website? Like if you're using open source tools, maybe you want to put up a mirror site so that everybody can upload or make patches from there versus going directly, right? That's something that crosses my lessons learned. And then last but not the least is the small vendors or small set expectations even with the smallest vendors, right? Like for example, most of these tools have one to two people who are maintaining it. So what is our policy for those, right? I mentioned curl, you know, you mentioned notebook, right? The curl comes to my mind because curl just closed their bug bounty program. There's only two people who are maintaining that code. And AI, as good as it is, it's opening up a lot of vulnerabilities that they just can't keep up the volume. So what's the process in an organization that uses curl all the time, right? So I think that expectations and policies will help go a long way as well.
Yeah, nothing can be too small to let it fly under the radar.
Exactly.
You know?
In the past, we ignored it, but we don't need to ignore it anymore with the ability for Gen AI to be able to not only crawl, but to understand and prioritize very quickly.
Jeff, and you kind of answered this question already, but I'll just, you know, any last thoughts before we move on to the final story for today? And any other lessons you feel like we can walk away from this learning?
Yeah, I think, I'll lean back to zero trust. To me, the thing that changes with zero trust is the assumption of breach. You assume the bad guy's already in your system. And that's not what we normally do. We normally assume, okay, my system is clean. Now I'm trying to keep the bad guy out. No, assume the bad guy's already in your system to begin with. Whatever tools you use, whatever things that you're depending on, your database, your apps, your network, your whatever, assume the bad guy's there. Now design your security. That's the real sea change that zero trust brought that I think got missed along the way because, again, the term got stretched and abused so much. But I still see that as a very valuable lesson that we should look at. It's not really fully achievable. I remember I talked to a CISO once of an organization. I asked, where are you on your zero trust? He said, yeah, we've done that. And I just nearly bit my tongue off. It's like, okay, then you don't understand what this is. I didn't say that to him, but that's just like saying security, yeah, we did that. You know, we're done with it. You know, the old thing about, you know, if you're satisfied with your security, so are the bad guys. So this is continuous, like Sridhar said, continuous monitoring is going to be what's necessary.
That's why we'll always have a show, because you can't ever be satisfied with security. Let's move on to our fourth and final story for the day. Dragonforce aims to be the next big ransomware cartel. Managed security services provider Level Blue published a comprehensive report on the Dragonforce ransomware gang last week. The overarching theme is they're trying to become the next big players in the field. Some of the highlights from their recent activity reported by Level Blue include a move to online registration, right? So there's no more extensive background checks for affiliates. You can sign up through a portal like you would on, like, I don't know, a Facebook account or something. Allowing affiliates to create their own brands under the Dragonforce aegis. Test runs to help affiliates practice launching attacks. And file analysis support, where folks from Dragonforce will help you find the juicy stuff in the data you stole, help you figure out how to communicate with your victims, write call scripts even for you so that you can deliver your ransom demands. Dragonforce also engaged in some attacks on competitors. I'm thinking of, you know, them defacing BlackRock's leak site recently. And they also called for collaboration, forming a coalition with Keylin and Lockbit to coordinate their activities. Basically, you know, one big monopoly, right? So, you know, a lot of movement here from Dragonforce, but I'm wondering if there's anything new or concerning, or is there anything that catches your eye here? And Nick, I'll throw to you first. You look at this activity from ransomware. Dragonforce. Does it change anything in the ransomware landscape, or is this same old, same old? What's your take?
And only for a small percentage of your haul will they help you with your entire nefarious mission.
it's great customer service, you know? I mean...
So they'll drive the getaway cars.
There you go. Whatever you got to do, right? Just to be a part of the team. And I think that's kind of it right there, is diversifying and making the tools available to whoever wants to pay to use them. And it's just, they're the next big thing. If they even become the next big thing, and if it's not them, it will be another to take their place. Because if something happens to them, it will open a power vacuum for another group to step in, or the same group to step in and change their name and pretend they're someone else. You know, just like we've seen with shiny happy hunters or shiny Lapsus hunters, whatever we want to call them these days. How many times have they gone away and come back? So the threat is real. It is definitely worth keeping an eye on and watching what they're doing. I'm a little concerned with them wanting to go back to old school and doing the data encryption and data theft at the same time, since most ransomware gangs now are just doing data theft and not worrying about encryption. So either they know something we don't, or I think they're just not paying attention to the room.
That makes a lot of sense. Sridhar, your take here, looking at this situation, any thoughts on how this changes the ransomware landscape at all, or you know, how we respond?
I think it changes quite a bit, right? I'm actually concerned over here, because now what used to be a hard thing to do and only people like Nick understood it, it becomes easy for anybody to understand and be able to hire these organizations for you know, whatever sum, return investment, it calls itself out, but people are not as experienced can go and leverage these organizations to be able to launch devastating attacks, right? That's what worries me. So to me, things like Dragonforce, more than the name and more than all of that, is they make hacktivism or cybersecurity, you know, hacking more professional, more scalable, more persistent, so that even a small timer is able to use the services to extract more money, as an example, right? What's the time value of this data, right? How do I do that? It gives them low barrier to entry, right? It blurs with some of the geopolitical situations that are surrounding us right now. So to me, I'm a bit worried about how these organizations are, you know, coming to bear very quickly. So, and then Jeff will probably add in, like, you know, one, and I'm sure they're using the same technology that is privy to us, i.e. cloud and AI, and be able to bring the barrier even further lower, right?
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. I think yeah. it was an inevitable end point, because this is where we have been heading all along.
Yeah, it's move fast, break things. And just that business model now being applied in this space, the level of professionalism, if you want to call it that, that's being added to this is what's kind of raising it up another notch, making it, lowering the barrier for the attacker by putting the harder stuff into the infrastructure. It's ransomware as a service. It's click here to hack. It's all of those kinds of things. And there was mention of, you know, the next group that comes along. I think the next group that comes along, we're actually already looking at. It's called AI agents. And they'll be able to do this stuff even better than the infrastructures that we set up otherwise. They'll set up the infrastructure and tear it down and set it up again and tear it down again. They'll identify targets. They will identify vulnerabilities. They'll execute on those vulnerabilities. They'll do the collections. All of this, you know, all of that can be completely automated with an agent that's running autonomously. And all someone has to do is just launch the thing. And so eventually the agents will probably put these guys out of business, and
you know, we'll all be really sorry that these ransomware guys lost their work, that they got replaced by AI. You know, a moment of silence for that.
A humble ransomware operator can't even find a job anymore. You know?
What's the world coming to?
What's the world coming to?
I don't see this as new because we've always had, you know, like warhead trickle down when it comes to these, highly complex vulnerabilities and the way that these attack campaigns are executed. And they just become easier over time because usually after a complex, a high end group does their thing, you're like, well, let's package it up and sell it now. And that's how we also end up with the term script kiddies, right? Because they didn't figure it out themselves. Most of the time they bought it from someone else. So this, I think the only novel part of this is them trying to become the Walmart of their group.
I think with becoming the Walmart of that group, Nick, right, has good and the bad. You know, we talked about some of the risks, the fact that low barrier to entry and scale and professionalism, customer support, all of that, right? But the other side of it is that they will have to use patterns to scale. Right, if they launched a phishing attack, if they compromised a VPN on a remote desktop or exposed a specific web page, those will be repeated. So the insight to defenders is look at your TTPs very closely, right? Because that's probably an indication of how some of these would. Meaning, each attack is not going to be a custom attack. Nick, is my point, right? Instead, they will have to scale with some level of patterns. But you're right in the sense that the common sense or the hygiene, which is preparing for a ransomware service attack, a ransomware type of attack, is important, right? In being able to prepare for, I think you're talking about the dual extortion, communication plan, data leakage, regulatory, all of that is important. That doesn't go away. But in addition, I think if we can look at the fact that these groups are sharing intels, these groups are sharing patterns, these groups are sharing tooling. What can we learn from that so that maybe we can use GenAI as a mechanism to go and read a TTP faster than anybody can and patch the systems faster, right?
If they become the Walmart of ransomware and this whole cybersecurity thing doesn't work out for us, maybe we become Walmart greeters for ransomware.
You know, one of the things I love about recording with this panel specifically is you basically do my job for me. I get to shut up and sit in the corner and you all talk. But that does it for this episode. We are out of time, folks. Thank you to our panelists, Nick and Sridhar and Jeff. Thank you to the viewers and listeners. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there. And the next time you're watching one of Jeff's videos, just tell him, get well soon, because he's going to need it with that shoulder.
Thank you.